60 and FM
103.3. Oh, man. Are we living in obscure times or what? And I'm not saying this is the only time in history that these times have been, you know, that times have been off kilter. But, I mean, you can go back and for many people, it's even within their generation. If you want to go back to the, you know, the 60s of civil rights and the Vietnam War. But this is different. This is different because this is more global. And you know, and it's, you bring religion into it, it just exacerbates the entire madness that's going on in the Middle East. And the sides that people are taking here, just let's just go back a few years. I'm not even saying let's go back into history or a generation ago or even 10 years ago. Let's just go back a few years. Pretty much we all got along pretty well. Yeah, we had some political differences, but oh my goodness, this is taking it to the nth degree here. Good morning, it's Gary Byron, 7-Eleven here on this Friday Eve. Our first guest into the Daily Connerton Memorial Company interview chair is a decorated Marine Operations Iraqi Freedom Attack helicopter pilot who served across the Middle East. He also served at the White House with Joint Chiefs of Staff and as a professor of national security strategy at the National War College. Let's welcome to the show retired Colonel Eric Buyer. Colonel, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, I am well, but I'm not digging the times that we're all living in. I would imagine you would agree with that as well as a lot of our listeners.
No, I do. These are very unique times, considering what we're seeing across college campuses, across some of our biggest cities in the country. It's an alarming trend, and I think it's going to be a wake up call for a lot of Americans.
I would say too. Iran has threatened to annihilate, wipe Israel off the map should it launch a major attack. What's the latest on that? I heard that, and then it just kind of went away.
Yeah, they've been rattling sabers for generations. The Iranians certainly are the single point of failure in the Middle East right now. The proxies are certainly Hamas. The proxies are the Hezbollah. They're the Houthis. And so they've attempted to play hardball with the Israelis. And we saw on the 1st of April, the Israelis, they don't fear the Iranians. They showed considerable restraint. They made an attack into the senior special forces of the Iranians, and the Iranians attempted to fire some drones back. And the Iranians are really at a tremendous military disadvantage. When you look at the strength of the Israeli Air Force. So they can posture, and they can use proxies, and they can use women and children, and they can use suicide bombers, but they're not wiping Israel anywhere.
No, and I saw, was it probably a couple of weeks ago, that Saturday afternoon in which Iran was, I guess that the weaponry I'm looking at, it looked antiquated. And to your point, so is the weaponry from Hezbollah and the Houthis and Hamas, and the Israeli weaponry is, I guess, pretty sophisticated. Is this the reason why they don't fear them? Is because they may be coming at many different angles towards Israel, but Israel's got the weaponry that can annihilate Iran and their proxies.
Certainly, I think it's on several levels from kind of a strategic positioning. The Israelis are in the right. I think the world knows that. The Iranians have a lot of internal discourse, a lot of friction between the hardliners and the more pragmatic Iranians. And as you mentioned, from a tactical perspective, there's no comparison. The Israelis are flying F-16s, F-35s. They can strike anywhere, anytime. The Iranians are using really dated technologies. They don't have an air force or a ground army that anyone would consider a threat.
But they've got to know that. They've got to know that. Why would they even fire these antiquated missiles that Israel is just laughing at going, you're kidding me, right? Why would they start it in the first place if they know their weaponry is outdated?
Well, they still want to send a message, right? Okay. They still think they're the regional superpower, and they need to embolden their proxies, which they have. You know, Hamas was trained by the Iranians for the 7 October attacks. Hezbollah, again, a longtime ally, all trained and funded by the Iranians. The Houthis, all trained and funded by the Iranians. So the Iranians, every once in a while, they've got to say, you know, hey, boys, we're in this with you, which we know is not the truth. They'd rather have everyone else take the casualties and take the potential elimination than the Iranians themselves. So it's a strange and continuing phenomenon, but we have to realize that Iran is the problem. They are the ones that continue to fund all these splinter groups and proxy forces.
When does that money run out?
Well, that's great. You know, we send such mixed messages. We're unwilling from a really political and a policy perspective at the highest levels of our country to make the required level of effort. I think we let the Iranians simply get away with a lot. Meanwhile, we feel very comfortable browbeating Benjamin Netanyahu. We feel very comfortable having sitting senators, you know, chastise leadership of Israel, really perplexing in a lot of ways. So from a U.S. foreign policy perspective, from a leadership perspective, you know, we need to embrace the only democracy in the Middle East. They can't be browbeaten and embarrassed by our short-sighted policies.
Colonel, I couldn't agree more, but based on your experience, what's the end game? I mean, what's the strategy? What's the exit strategy here?
So what we've seen it done, not particularly effectively, is we need to separate the proxies from the Iranians. That'll leave the Iranians exposed. We've done it on a very small scale. We had some Americans killed, as you remember, in Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
That was the Islamic resistance in Iraq. And several days later, we did do significant damage to them to the point where they said, hey, we're out. We're no longer participating. We want out. We don't want to be completely decimated by U.S. forces. So that's been effective. Isolate the Houthis, continue to isolate Hamas, which is being done, continue to make Hezbollah less effective. And then you've essentially stripped the Iranians of any way to project power. It's long, it's tedious. But if you isolate those supporting the Iranians, you'll find ways to minimize their effects.
How do you see the U.S. involvement in this war moving forward? Is it strictly from a monetary purpose, where we are providing the Israelis with money? Is it humanitarian aid in Gaza, which we all know that, you know, Hamas, which is their governing body, is going to take it and use it for their purposes? I mean, the Biden administration can sugarcoat and say, this is for humanitarian purposes. Yeah, it may be for that purpose going out, but on the receiving end, Hamas is receiving it, and it's not going to humanitarian purposes. That's just me opining on this. But how do you see the U.S. involvement going forward?
Well, I think it'll be much of what we see now, much of the status quo. Continue to fund the Israelis quietly. The Israelis, they're flying F-35s, flying F-15s, ensuring they have a continued supply of what they need militarily. That's what we need to do as supporting the only democracy in the area. And like we briefly said, you know, the humanitarian aid is required. I mean, we're all empathetic. No one wants anyone suffering, especially families, women and children. You can understand that. But we also, like you pointed out, that Hamas has been given billions and billions of dollars from the Qataris, from a lot of their neighbors, to simply build infrastructure, to build schools. They've done none of it. You know, this humanitarian crisis is of their own making. They had no plan. They didn't stockpile water or simple supplies they knew their people would need, because they just don't care about them. It's all about preserving Hamas in their radicalization of the Palestinians.
The White House says U.S. support for Israel is ironclad and will support their defense amid an Iranian attack. Now, if this turns into a full-out war, do you think Biden would put U.S. troops on the ground?
Oh, I don't believe this president would risk anything. He is swayed by the smallest of political and social minorities. For him, it's about political, preservation for him. So, no, I don't think it'll come to that. Certainly, it's complicated. It's complex. Israel, we have to remember, is also they're a very competent, capable military force. They can defend themselves against the Iranians. I don't think the Iranians would be so emboldened to try additional conventional strikes. We talked about their base, their middle class is very, very disappointed from a leadership perspective. You look at the millions of Iranian women since the 1979 revolution. They've gone back in time 50 years. What they can do, what their society expects the role of women to be, all these really major Western and democratic issues that are used to be a right in Iran, but after their revolution, it's a very, very, very difficult place to live if you're a woman. You want to be educated. You're a man who wants to live outside what would be these strict norms. So they have their own problems in Iran. Invading Israel is really would be a downfall to the regime.
What is life like in Israel right now? I mean, is are schools in? Are people going to work? Or if you can just paint the picture. People think of a country in war that are being bombed as being very war torn, and panic and streets are cars are being overturned and people are running wild in the streets. What is it really like there, though?
So, for my research, certainly after the October 7th, the entire nation was on a war footing. It was what we would call a total war. The entire economy, the military, felt rightfully they were in an existential war of existence. They felt their lives were rightfully threatened. The death of over 1,200, really families and farmers, and in the most brutal way. So they were on a complete war footing. Activated the reserve units. Really spent a lot of time doing serious military planning. The country has come back to normal. Schools are open, running businesses are open. You go Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, obviously always a hot spot, but Tel Aviv and poor cities like Haifa, the economies are back up, but the nation still remains on a war footing. And so much more difficult for us to understand unless you see it, unless you spend any time in Israel, then you understand how seriously they take their national defense.
I got to take a break here. It's short, but when we come back, I want to ask you how much of this is about oil, how much of this is about religion, okay? More when we come back right after this.
Now that spring has sprung, it's time to get your new grill or air conditioner. Ferrari's Appliance has all the name brands at the price you can afford. And they install and service everything they sell. Enough with the pushy salespeople and impersonal customer service. Head to Ferrari's Appliance in Newington or Naugatuck and discover why people from all over choose them over everyone else. Online at Ferrari'sAppliance.com.
If you're like me, you appreciate delicious food at reasonable prices. Hey, it's Gary Byron, and every Friday I head out to dinner at some of Connecticut's most delicious restaurants, from Abigail's Grill and Wine Bar in Simsbury to the fun atmosphere at Market Grill in Manchester, the Republic Gastro Pub in Bloomfield, and the romantic atmosphere of Mill on the River in South Windsor, quickly becoming one of my favorites. Any of these unforgettable locations is going to be perfect for any dining experience. Check them out online at millrestaurantgroup.com. And let's all meet up.
When you hit our button in the morning, AM 1360, FM 103.3, we hit you back with Gary Byron at News and Talk Without an Agenda.
25 minutes after the hour of 7, our guest is retired Marine Colonel Eric Bouyer. look, these countries have been fighting. Israel's been at war, it seems, with Palestinians since the beginning of time. And we all know Palestine is what? It's not really a country, right?
Correct. So if we look back, you know, you're right. It's been thousands of years. They both call it their homeland.
Right.
I'd say the best way to describe the last 25 plus years is in 2000, they were offered all of the Gaza Strip, mm-hmm. Have a two-state solution between Yasser Arafat and the end of the Clinton administration. That was rejected. As of 2006, there's no Israelis in Gaza. Israel forcibly removed 50,000 Israelis, left behind infrastructure, farms, vineyards, orchards, and gave them essentially what they wanted. And so it's a battle of ideology. It's a battle of religions in a lot of ways, and that's what makes it even more difficult to find a lasting resolution, which I think the world had thought had happened until the October 7th attack.
Yeah, so I'm glad that you said that, because that's where I was going next. What precipitated that? You know, there was the rock concert that was going on in Israel, and we know that these religions, we know that these individuals, we know that these people have not gotten along since, you know, forever. But so what? And there's been relatively peace. Even though they don't like each other and their neighbors, there's been peace for all intents and purposes. So what was behind then that October 6th attack?
So when you look at Iran's political and military, their clerical leaders have been consistently at odds with one another. And the 2020 assassination of their special forces commander by Americans in Baghdad, Soleimani, really gave the more radical clerics and hardliners the upper hand. And so it was their idea to take a more direct approach to the West. That's code for take direct approach, be more militaristic against the Israelis. And so that was best exemplified by the attacks in October. So what that does, it's superheating already a boiling cauldron across Iran. So there's so much pressure inside Iran right now. And so the ideologues, they won the vote that day. They took a much more hard line against the West, which is, again, how do you strike Israel and how do you strike America? And you're right. There's ideology that goes back thousands of years. But if you simply look at Hamas's charter, read the Houthis' charter, it's death to America, death to Israel, death to Jews. The list goes on, right? No one's really excluded from that list. It goes on to include every single potential protester in this country. They've made the list. They just don't know it yet. So it's a long battle of ideology. As Golda Meir once said, peace will come to the Arabs when they love their children more than they hate us. And so it's never been more true.
How does this end? I could ask when you look, we don't have a crystal ball. I could ask you when you predict it'll end. And I guess maybe in order for it to end, how would it end?
So like most all wars, there has to be a negotiated political settlement that both sides are uncomfortable with. Both sides feel they somehow were wronged with. I mean, they have to live the level of uncomfort and discomfort. In this case, it has to be a political solution. The people of Palestine deserve the right to go back to their lives. The Israeli Defense Forces have the right to root out.
Sure. But when do you think that will happen? I only have about 30 seconds. When do you think that would occur?
It's happening now. I mean, these talks have begun long earlier when you saw last year the Saudis and the Israelis talking together. It's going to take great pushes from the Qataris, the Omanis, and the Saudis, and I think those talks are already underway. I think that is the only path forward, some type of negotiated settlement.
Colonel, thank you for your time this morning in shedding some light on this.
Celebrating 100 years. Number one for breaking news for Vernon, Farmington, and South Windsor. The Talk of Connecticut. AM 1360 and FM 103.3.
We are less than 1 week away from the final day of the 2024 legislative session here in the state of Connecticut. It is a short session, which means that they end the first Wednesday after the first Monday in May, as opposed to June, which was last year, and what will be again next year in the longer session. And by the way, I call them the bookend months. It also means that they started the first Wednesday after the first Monday in February rather than January. So just a little, just trying to keep you updated. Now, we talk about budgets, it seems like every year, in a question that no matter what, every year, people ask me, both on the air and off, but Gary, I thought you said it's a biennium budget. Well, that's every other year. That's the longer session. Why are we talking about a budget in the in-between year? Well, and that's a fair question. It's a valid question. And yes, it's a popular question. And the short answer to that is the budget, the biennium budget that we do are based on projections, okay? In other words, we don't get the final numbers until after we've already voted on it. I know it sounds weird. I didn't create it. It's been like that for eons. That doesn't make it right, by the way, just because don't let anybody tell you, well, that's the way we do it because that's the way we've always been doing it. That's never a good answer, by the way. But I'm just telling you. So what ends up happening is that there are projections that are made so that the in-between year, like right now, like this year, I would call them more budget tweaks. Okay, I hope I cleared that up. Good morning, it's Gary Byron, 8:11 here on this Friday Eve. Our next guest into the Daily Connerton Memorial Company interview chair is the House Republican leader who, by the way, joins us every other Thursday. We always appreciate his time, particularly right now when he's in the throes of the end of session, because that Wednesday that I mentioned a little while ago is coming up this upcoming Wednesday. Let's welcome back to the show Vinny Candelora. Vin, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
You must be spent.
Yeah, I'm well rested. It hasn't been too difficult this session.
Yeah, I've heard that, actually. Did I explain that properly, by the way?
You did. I think there's one piece to add. You know, each year we do a biennium budget, but each year you have to look at it and make adjustments, especially if it's in deficit, because we have a constitutional obligation to have a balanced budget each fiscal year, is what our Constitution says. It's not just every 2 years, it's every year it needs to be in balance.
Right, so, but I call that a tweak.
It is. It's a tweak. Yeah. It's supposed to be an adjustment. And what's happened this year is the governor in February recognized that we have we are $30 million over the constitutional spending cap. So we also had deficits that we had to shore up. So he proposed an adjusted budget to make fixes and be in keeping with our Constitution. Democrats decided this is too hard to do. Let's just go home. And it looks like the governor is saying, okay, we'll go home and not do it. So it's really egregious. That's why Republicans put out our own budget to show, look, you can balance it, and you have an obligation to balance it. And keep that promise to the voters, which they're not doing.
Okay. Let me start. There's a bunch of questions that I have. I want to ask some questions to you that are actually from some of the listeners who know that you were coming on today. But I'll get to those in a moment. You were talking about the budget. And last I heard that the Republicans actually proposed some budget adjustments. What's the current update on these proposals that the Republicans put forward?
Yeah, I mean, the governor.
Whoop, are you there? Vin? Vinny?
One of the things.
We lost you there, buddy. Go ahead. Can you start from the beginning? Cause...
Sorry about that. Yeah, they said thanks, but no thanks. they don't want to open the budget. They like some of the stuff we did, but they're choosing not to do it.
Was that a surprise?
Yeah, it's surprising from the governor, who is saying he wants to protect the fiscal cap. And you can't do that without doing budget adjustments. So I'm a little surprised the governor is caving. He is setting us up for these caps to be attacked. next year. Democrats are already saying they're going to look at repealing and adjusting them. So I'm surprised the governor is getting in bed with that notion. You know, the other issue is that our budget funds the special ed costs grant that the state gives to our towns. When we did the budget last year, we promised we were going to fully fund it, which has never been done. Unfortunately, it fell short by almost $80 million. So we're putting $80 million into special education to keep that promise.
Okay. So, so rather than offering budget adjustments, I guess what the Democrats are they thinking of using ARPA funds to spend as in key areas?
Yeah, I mean, they're looking at ARPA for higher ed, yeah, mental health, and nonprofits. And what they're effectively going to do is they're going to take the ARPA that was earmarked last year. Those projects are going to move into bonding. So they're going to bond about $250 million and then take all that money that they would have otherwise spent on the programs that they're bonding and spend it on new programs, you know, for higher ed or nonprofits. So they're really creating a gigantic hole, you know, going into next year's budget. That ARPA money needs to be spent. We agree with that. Mm-hmm. It needs to be spent on one-time revenues, not reoccurring.
Okay. What about consensus revenue estimates? How does that factor in?
Yeah, so consensus revenue came out. We are seeing more money coming into the state. So for 2024, we do now have, I think it's $125 million surplus, and we have more money that's going into the volatility cap and the rainy day fund, and therefore paying down our pensions, which that's what that cap was meant to do. So while we have more money coming in, we don't have more money from operations. And Democrats want to take that money, but what people need to understand is there's a spending cap that says, whoa, you can't spend that much. Mm-hmm. But they want to violate that cap too. So they need to plow through two of our fiscal guardrails in order to spend more.
But the governor doesn't want to do that, right?
Well, the governor says he doesn't want to do it, but he's doing it by getting in bed with them. So I'm looking forward to seeing this package, and I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, which side of the mouth the governor is going to decide to talk out of as he signs this bill.
Well, sales, last I was told, sales tax revenue is down, right?
Yeah, it's an alarming economic indicator. It's down by over $325 million. It's significant. So it is definitely a concern that the economy is slowing down. We shouldn't be ignoring those numbers.
No, I you're preaching to the choir. I want to talk to you. There was about marijuana right now. There was a bill. I think there was a passed a bill to close a loophole that allowed the sales of like this, you know, the THC infused seltzer in grocery stores and convenience stores. And it's basically what, allowing kids to buy it. Can you give us, you know, the skinny on this?
The short answer is that these THC laced seltzers, are created out of hemp, which, you know, is federally and state regulated. You know, hemp is allowed to, or hemp growers, manufacturers are allowed to derive all sorts of products. One of those products was a seltzer that has THC in it. I think it's like 3 milligrams of THC. So it is intoxicating. They're unregulated because it's a hemp product. So these they can be sold to anybody of any age at any location. And the concern is you really don't want kids drinking this stuff. So we passed a law to the House that would move those products into package stores.
Did you ever have discussions with the Dems to maybe allow police to pull over vehicles if they see someone smoking weed I got to tell you, my friend, every time I drive on the highway, it used to just be Hartford, but now it's really everywhere. I feel like I'm following Cheech and Chong, yeah, really. In their low rider.
It is everywhere.
Everywhere.
I remember as a kid, they talked about the Autobahn, you know, in Europe and how scary it was to drive on that road. Everyone goes really fast. And I think that's now the norm in the state of Connecticut. The highways are just white knuckled when you drive them. And I don't think a day goes by without me smelling pot.
Yeah.
With all the traveling. And that's a bad statistic. So the Democrats, when they commercialized marijuana, they added a provision in to prohibit the cops from pulling people over if they witness them smoking pot or if they smell pot.
Mm.
So the police's hands are tied. The Democrats have incentivized drug driving. And as they try to take the moral high ground and say we're going to lower the blood alcohol level, that's going to fix the problem. And meanwhile, they ignore the fact that they have allowed for people to drive while smoking pot and not be pulled over. We put an amendment forth that would say, A, you could be pulled over if you're witnessing them smoking pot, but also they could be pulled over if they're smoking pot and the kids are in the car. And sadly, both amendments fail. The Democrats, for whatever reason, want to protect a pot smoker who's driving on the road at all costs, even if it impacts children.
My God. So forget it then. We're not going to be reinstating an officer's ability to perform a consent search, it sounds like.
That's right. I mean, there are consent searches are off the table. They have qualified immunity. Where they've impacted police officers' personal liability when they do their job. I've never seen a profession more micromanaged than our police officers up in Hartford.
Why anybody want to be a cop anymore?
It's disgusting. Exactly.
We're living in bizarro world. All right, tell you what, Vin, I was going to wait another minute, but I want to bring up this big green monster climate bill. And rather than interrupt you, I'm going to take the break now, and then when we come back, let's tackle that. All right. As well as a couple of listener questions. I want to get them in there, too. More with House Republican Leader Vinnie Kindler right after this.
Yankee Peddler and Pawn in East Hartford is Connecticut's premier pawn shop, paying you top dollar whether you are pawning or selling your items. It's also your first choice to find great deals on used items. Yankee Peddler and Pawn has everything from gold and silver jewelry to electronics, power tools, some musical instruments, and so much more. With nearly 200 five-star Google reviews, customer service is always their number one priority. Go see Joe at Yankee Peddler and Pawn at 7 Pitkin Street in East Hartford and tell them Gary sent you.
Getting quality employees to fill positions in your company is essential, but finding those people can be a major hassle. Unless you use ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality people a breeze. ZipRecruiter's advanced technology identifies candidates with the right skills, sends you great matches, then you can easily invite them to apply. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free to try ZipRecruiter for free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free.
Number one for breaking news for Vernon, Canton, and Rocky Hill. The talk of Connecticut. AM 1360, FM 103.3.
All righty. 23 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock, our guest is House Republican Leader Vinnie Kindler, who joins us every other Thursday, leapfrogging with Senate Republican Leader Steve Harding, who will be with us next Thursday. Okay. This green monster climate bill, all I know, and I want you to kind of give us all the details, is that it comes from State Representative Christine Palm's climate bill that want to, electrify our state and completely rid ourselves from fossil fuels, okay? Take it from here, because that's all I really know about this bill.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, there's a lot of task forces put in there. And they're setting goals of reducing carbon and effectively eliminating, gas-powered products. And so, for instance, they want to move to the heat pump system for homes, for heating your homes. And I think the biggest concern that Republicans have with all of these initiatives is cost. Ratepayers and taxpayers and families can't afford these proposals. And the problem with these pieces of legislation is they do it at all costs. They don't care what the economics are, and they don't care if there's very little rate of return. for those proposals. So, you know, you think about it.
Doesn't make sense.
If we're going to reduce the carbon in Connecticut to zero, what impact does that really have on the entire planet? And so it's just very ambitious. It's radical. And it's too costly. You know, at the same time they pushed that agenda, we still don't know where they are on EVs. I mean, remember, they finally agreed we need a roadmap. We need to plan for the elimination of gas-powered cars.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they have neglected to raise that bill and address how they're going to deal with electric vehicles. The grid is not going to be able to handle all of this. So as they're shifting all of these
interesting
proposals, you know, to, like, for instance, the heat pumps, you're still going to need electricity. You're still going to need fossil fuels as backup for these different programs. Just really, it's ill-conceived. It's stupid.
But natural gas is affordable energy. You know, it's and upgrading these the grid, I would imagine, is going to, holy cow, that's got to be an astronomical bill that's going to fall on us, the ratepayer, right?
It will, and Eversource and UI are divesting from Connecticut at this very moment.
Oh,
so the two, you know, don't reconcile with each other. You know, at the same time, you have China and India. For every coal plant we're shutting down, they're building three. You know, so this isn't something that we're going to be able to fix without a globally collective decision-making and commitment. So, I, you know, the virtue signaling in there just kind of makes me sick. It is not going to change anything other than cost Connecticut taxpayers even more money.
What about a bill that would require batteries sold in Connecticut to be certified green and without child labor?
Well, you know, so yesterday they pounded their chest and passed a resolution to have the federal government, you know, entered a compact that the federal government banned child labor. Feel-good bill, doesn't do anything. And we said, you know what, put your money where your mouth is. If you really care about child labor, why don't you put a bill in that we will only buy batteries that are certified green and not made with child labor? Because these lithium-ion batteries that made for the vehicles are mined with 20% child labor. I think there's one statistic we saw. And the Democrats voted that down. They said, no, we prefer to have children working in the mines and so we could drive our Teslas.
Okay. All right. Which Dems are pro-EV mandate? Because we want to make them famous for all the wrong reasons.
Well, I mean, I would assume they all are. You know, it's a Democrat initiative. We need collectively, you know, two dozen Democrats to come on board with us to be able to shift away from these mandates. And thus far, we don't have that. So I would assume that they're all continuing to support the governor and their leadership's initiative to mandate EVs in the state of Connecticut.
Yeah, because the general public, including many Democrats, it's not like I only associate with Republicans. Half the time, I don't even know. I don't care what party affiliation they are. But just in discussion, oh my goodness, an overwhelming majority, probably in the 90 percentile, are against this EV mandate.
Yeah.
So to find out that their legislator is not doing the will of their constituents, which is what they're elected to do, we want to exploit that.
The Democrats are trying to commit murder on gas-powered vehicles.
Yeah.
And hide the murder weapon. So that's why we're not seeing honest, open discussion about a blueprint. They're burying it all, and they're going to see how they could sneak this past the voters without them realizing.
Is there a bill that would mandate open spaces like broken-down malls and things like, just to use them as an example, and turn it into low-income housing?
So there is a bill floating around to allow for as-of-right conversions of certain commercial spaces into residential housing. I've not yet seen the language yet. I know our ranking member on the Housing Committee, Tony Scott, is looking at it. They are trying to cobble together some sort of housing bill that might be run today or tomorrow, but we don't have all the details yet. But that is one piece to allow for commercial places to be converted as of right for housing purposes.
I have about 40 seconds remaining. What can we do? What can the our listeners here do that would help you? Because the next time we talk, the session will be over as this Wednesday, and we won't talk for a couple weeks.
They should pay attention and email and speak their mind on legislation they don't like. The worst thing we can have happen is that people don't talk because the legislators think that everything is going fine. And so regardless of the issue, if you're passionate about it, pick up the phone and let your rep or senator know. It does have an impact on this process.
I say it all the time. Well, we hope, because we also know that a lot of Democrat legislators have their marching orders.
Yeah.
You know, for the Democrat agenda, whether it's on the state level or if it's coming down from the feds. Vin, excellent job this morning, as always, my friend. We'll do it again in 2 weeks. Keep fighting for us.
242-41 Daily Contact, where memories live forever.
Flashbangs, heard smoke scene. Police in LA.
Like the Talk of Connecticut on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and stay up to date and connected with the Talk of Connecticut. FM 103.3 Hartford and 104.5 Litchfield.
9/11 here on the old clock. It's Gary Byron, our next guest into the Daily Connerton Memorial Company interview chair, joins us every month. And I got to tell you, there's no time like the present. You know, you talk about turmoil in your life. You talk about turmoil here. On a town level or on a national level, how about on a global level? And how about strife in a part of the world where what seems like the beginning of time, there's been fighting? Let's welcome back to the show from Lifeway Church, Pastor Joel Rissinger. Pastor, good morning.
Gary Byron, the man, the legend. It's great to be with you, my friend. Happy Thursday.
Happy World Religion Day, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. I can't keep track of all these days. There are so many things now that we tack. It's actually
National Day of Prayer. Day of Prayer, yes.
Yep. Yeah. Right. Which is, you know, but I don't know about World Religion Day. I don't know.
No, I meant National Day of Prayer. That's the one I meant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You could have fooled me, buddy.
There's no fooling you, Pastor Joel. You got to wake up pretty early in the morning, and not many people wake up earlier than you do. So,
well, we try. Although I, you know, heard about your neck there, buddy, and I'm sorry, you know, that you're getting older. I understand. I feel your pain. You know. You turn your head.
I did.
Snap, you get up and everything's pop, crackle. You sound like a cracker, a cereal box.
It was so stupid. I'm literally, this was about an hour ago. I'm sitting here and I just turned my neck. I mean, I don't know. And I'm like, oh, man, I pinch it. Ay, ay, ay. And I don't want to complain.
Good thing it's radio, not TV, because they'd be looking at you, you know, turned sideways away from the mic, having to, you know, do gyrations to sit upright.
That's why we work in radio, my friend. Although you and I used to work in radio together, we did an afternoon drive show.
It was a lot of fun.
It was.
I mean, I think we enjoyed it far more than our audience, but we had a good time.
It was like the pastor and the pastor and the politician or something like
the
that.
The pastor and the politician.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. Well, I was still in office there. Listen, there is so much going on in the Middle East.
Yeah.
So. And we can look at it from a military angle, from oil, the perspective of oil. They have all the oil. Let's look at it from a theological perspective. And this is, I kind of waited for this conversation until you were able to join us on the show. It really does go back to what seems like the beginning of time. Can you break that down for us? And what is this all about?
You know, it's if you read different accounts and different historical views, you'll have different timelines. You know, some will point to the 1948 UN resolution. Some will point back, you know, much further. Some will go back to the time of Jacob, who became Israel and Esau. I would go right back to Father Abraham. You know, I think the conflict started when Abraham decided to kind of solve the problem, that being that he had no heir, solve it his way instead of God's way. And so at his wife's suggestion, of course, it didn't take much convincing, he slept with her servant Hagar and had a son, Ishmael. And then God says, well, no, that's not the one. I've told you Sarah will have a child. It's going to be a miracle. You have to trust me. And of course he did. He ultimately trusted him. And ultimately Sarah had a son, Isaac. who was the father of Jacob, who became Israel. But the conflict started between these two women and the jealousy over you know, whose child was going to be the heir of the promise and the inheritor of the covenant promises to Abraham. And Ishmael was blessed, and it was said he would be kind of nomadic, but he would have, you know, a great nation, and he'd be at odds with other nations and brothers around him. Isaac was the one to whom the covenant promise, the ultimate blessing, really came and hit through him and his descendants. And I would say that the battle between Israel and Arab nations began right there, and has continued and escalated back and forth for, you know, 4,000 years now, ultimately. I think, too, people forget, you know, when you see these protests, Gary, and you see all the people standing up, even for Hamas. I mean, mm-hmm. I've gotten to chuckle a couple of times at groups that will stand up and say they support Hamas, who, if they were under Hamas's reign, would be literally slaughtered. The LGBTQ community, for example, you see people standing with the rainbow flag and "We support Hamas" signs. You wouldn't support them if you were there, because you wouldn't be alive. People forget this stuff. But when you look at the conflict between the Palestinians, as well as the various terrorist groups supported by Iran, and you consider the roots of it all, it's really amazing. Israel today is a portion, a fraction of what God gave them and what was promised. I mean, Canaan, the land of Canaan that was promised to them, encompasses parts of Syria, Jordan. I mean, it's the entire nation of Israel, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the whole shebang. And they've given up major portions of what they were originally promised and given already. So the idea that they are the aggressor because they're holding on to this land is basically an idea that's, well, how can I put it, ignorant of history, the ultimate history, and of God's promise to his people. And as Christians in particular, theologically, I think we ought to stand with Israel. We ought to support them. We ought to pray for them. We ought to recognize that they were under attack here, and they are already living with a portion of what was rightfully, divinely theirs. I'm saddened to see Christians, you know, backing the Palestinian cause, in particular Hamas and some of these terrorist groups. It just shouldn't be.
Whose land was it first, Pastor? Was it, when we talk of Israel, and I've mentioned this a few times, that was Judea. Let's go way, let's go far back. Whose land was it originally?
Well, there were multiple tribal groups that were displaced when Israel conquered the land under Joshua. Probably most prominent, and the one that often gets looked at historically the most, is the Philistines, or are the Philistines. Some would try to make a comparison to the Palestinians. In fact, the root word from Greek was very similar, and the name Palestinian, or the Palestinian territory, was given by the Greeks. But in terms of genetic roots, that's dicey. I mean, in other words, I don't know that we can literally genetically trace the ancient Philistines to modern Palestinians. I don't think that flies.
All right, then I'll ask the opposite question. Palestine is not a nation, right? It's a territory.
It's a territory, and it was a name given, like I said, by the Greeks. But right.
But it keeps moving.
About original possessors of that land, it was multiple tribal groups. It really wasn't just one group or one nation per se.
Okay, so does it keep moving, Palestine, or has it always been that area, that geographical location?
It's moved, I suppose, in the sense that just as Israel's territory has moved, right, and they've lost pieces of it, so to speak, over time. Of course, you know, under Babylonian captivity and Assyrian captivity, they lost everything in essence for a season. In that sense, it's probably moved, but generally, I think for the last, 100 years, it's been that territory that's in the middle of the conflict now, All of Israel, plus the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, etc.
Was it originally Ottoman?
When you say Palestine, that's what most people would think of.
But it was originally Ottoman territory, correct?
Well, again, how far back do we want to go, right? I mean, prior to the UN resolution, you're probably right, but if we go back 4,000 years, or not even 4,000, 2,000 years, we're looking at a territory probably that was shared among more than one nation.
All right, so who is claiming whom for stealing their land?
Well, today, of course, the Palestinians that have been displaced after 1948 are blaming Israel and the UN, I suppose, the West in general, for being displaced. The question is, you know, were they even a nation before? The answer is probably no, they weren't. There were other Arab nations, of course, surrounding them who didn't take them in. This is another part of the conflict that rarely gets discussed, is even though theologically they're Muslim nations around them for the most part, and the Palestinians would mostly be Muslim people, they were not brought in by their brothers. They were not welcomed. They weren't considered. And of course, under the PLO, one of the original terrorist groups, they were not trusted. So they, they were not. They were people without a home. They were nomads without a home, kind of like what was prophesied about Ishmael way back at the time of Abraham. And so they blame Israel, of course, for taking or possessing their land. Israel would look all the way back to, you know, the time of the, of the founding of their nation, before Christ, long before Christ, and say, well, this was land promised to us, you know, at the time that we came into Canaan.
All right.
It just depends on who you talk to, I guess, as to who displaced who.
I got to take a break here. But when we come back, I want to bring the religious aspect into this whole situation and scenario, and talk about the differences then of having two neighbors who've been fighting each other for this property, and Muslims in differentiating themselves religiously. From Jews. More with Pastor Joel Risinger right after this.
Time is precious. Between work, the kids, and caring for an ailing mom, I have less and less free time. So the time I spend with mom, I want to be meaningful. That's why I leave the cooking, cleaning, and laundry to Euro American Home Care for You. They do it all so that my time with mom is about us, not chores.
Make your time together memorable and leave the cleaning, cooking, laundry, bathing, and errands to Euro American Home Care of Berlin. 860-829-0208. That's 860-829-0208. 829-0208. Online at homecare, the number 4, the letter U.com.
No one ever likes calling their insurance company. It usually means there's a problem. And when there's a problem, you don't want to talk to a stranger. You want your agent, the agent who knows you. That's Michael Van Otterkirk and his staff at State Farm of Newington. State Farm has been the number one auto insurer in the U.S. every year since 1946. So when a problem arises, you'll be relieved to call State Farm of Newington, 860-666-1037. Because like a good neighbor, State Farm of Newington is there.
Number one for breaking news for Vernon, Farmington, and South Windsor. The Talk of Connecticut. AM 1360 and FM 103.3.
24 minutes after the hour of 9, our guest, Pastor Emeritus from Lifeway Church on the Berlin Turnpike in Newington. He joins us every month, Pastor Joel Risinger. I mean, we've looked at it from all different angles, from oil, from land. Let's look at it from a theological perspective with differences of religion. You've got Muslims, you've got Jews. How does that factor into the equation of this war?
Good stuff, Gary. That is the question, and I think that is the primary issue. Just a quick comment, by the way. I don't know that this is accurate, but I had heard that in terms of oil, the Gaza Strip in particular,
there's no oil.
More portions of Israel, no oil there.
Yeah,
fight
no
over.
Oil there, right?
And yet you have people arguing that this is about Israel maintaining oil rights, and I'm like, what oil rights? But anyway, that's a side issue. No, I think the religious issue is the main issue, and it has been for centuries. And it's a question of which God do we serve, right? Now, some would argue it's the same God. I disagree wholeheartedly. That would take us hours to address, but they are not the same, and they don't have the same promises given to them, nor do they have the same understanding of history. Islam, which came in 600 years after Christ, came to be, has a much different view of history and a different perspective than does Judaism or Christianity, for that matter. Israel believes, and I believe historically this can be proven, and it's right and accurate, that they were given this land by God, and that's true. And so they believe that it was his covenant promise all the way back to the time of Abraham, who, by the way, the Muslims also claim as their ultimate father of the faith. And they'll stand on that to the death, that this is land they were given, land they should have, and so forth. You know, the Muslims have a different perspective, that the Jews co-opted the land, that they rewrote history, that they destroyed all the historical documents showing, in fact, that, you know, they don't have a right to all this. And they believe Allah has told them to either convert these Jews, which they see as backslidden Muslims, or kill them. And that's what the Quran, I mean, people argue against this, but I mean, you read Muhammad's writings, you read the writings of the other prophets of Islam, and you find that that is, in fact, true. You convert or you die. Those are your choices. And so this conflict won't go away.
That sounds more like a cult.
Solution or discussion of oil rights or anything else. It is a much deeper spiritual problem.
Convert or we kill you. That sounds more like a cult than a religion.
Well, yeah, I would agree, Gary, but that is the ultimate foundation of Islam in terms of outreach or evangelism, if you want to look at it that way. And this is what Iran for sure believes. Their imams believe this, and they've made it very clear that their objective in supporting Hamas and other terrorist groups, as well as now their own direct aggression, they've made it very clear that they want to kill all the Jews. And by that, they don't just mean descendants of the tribe of Judah. They mean all 12 tribes and all Americans as well, the USA and Christians in general. We either need to come under their authority and submit to Allah and the teachings of the Quran, or we should all die. And so I laugh about this sometimes. You know, we've given them politically the ability to develop nuclear power and nuclear weaponry, ultimately, you know, through treaties from President Obama and now President Biden. It's the analogy I've used is, if you get into an elevator and there's a guy standing there that says, "I'm here to kill you," you don't hand him a knife, right? I mean, you don't say, "Yeah, okay, well, here, let me help you out," and assume that because you gave him a knife, he's going to change his mind. Theologically, spiritually, this is a very deeply held belief, and that's why the ultimate source of the conflict is deeper than what can be negotiated through just territory, oil rights, political wranglings, et cetera, et cetera.
I keep hearing that Muslims are very peaceful people and that it's really the radical side of, but I don't hear radical Catholics or radical Christians or radical Jews or radical, what is that? What's the difference between a Muslim and in Islam?
Well, that's a great question, and I, you know, we would have to add that, yeah, historically, under the time of the Crusades, the Catholic Church did march on and slaughter Muslims. I would argue it was in retaliation to, you know, years of attacks on outposts throughout Europe, et cetera. But be that as it may, it doesn't justify that response and the way it was carried out. But and that's a good example.
Really quick.
That was done based on human leadership, not biblical teaching. A radical Muslim believes the Quran and takes it literally and acts on it. A radical Christian takes the Bible seriously, where Jesus said things like, love your enemies, right?
Okay.
Do good to them.
Right. All right.
The radical Muslim believes kill the infidel, because that's what the book says.
I still need to know the difference between a Muslim and in Islam. But I'm out of time, Pastor Joel. We'll talk to you down the road. Thank you for your time this morning.
Okay, my friend. Blessings.
Blessings to you. Happy...
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Therese Crowley. Three lines of California law...